Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studios in Beijing. I'm your host, Kaiser Guo.
So, joining me here as we bid farewell to 2011 and ring in of the new year is Cynical co-host Jeremy Goldcorn, manbehinddanwei.com.
Hi, Kaiser.
Back with us on Cynica is China Geeks blogger Charlie Custer, who's been closely following both of today's topics. We'll tell you what those are in just a minute.
Hey.
So first, why don't you take a second, actually, to tell listeners about the documentary you've been working on, Living with Dead Hearts. Tell people where they can go, especially to pitch in some money.
Sure. So yeah, we're making this documentary film that's about kidnapped children in China, mostly following sort of the parents and the things they go through to get their kids back, hence the title Living with Dead Hearts. And if you would like to help us make that, you can go to livingwithdeadhearts.com.
Actually, there's a link on the front of your blog, right?
There's a link in directions and all the stuff on China Geeks as well, so you can just go there.
Yeah, great. We're also pleased to welcome back Ed Wong of the New York Times. Great to see you, Ed.
Nice to see you. Happy New Year.
Thanks. And rounding out today's discussion and making his long-awaited return to Cynica is Gadi Epstein, correspondent for The Economist. Welcome back, Gadi.
Thank you.
Now, there is a lot that we could be talking about today, like Christian Bale's Adventures in Ligny or the long sentences which the Chinese government decided to hand down to dissidents in the last week. Nice Christmas present. But actually, we've picked two very meaty topics. First up, the dramatic events that unfolded in the village of Wuhan. A small village went into what some have called open revolt. Villagers chased out the local party leadership, held many days of protests, and managed to actually have most of their demands met. Very interesting. So first, Wuhan.
I was down there for the last phase of the protest, which is when they were at a standoff with the government.
Yeah, we'll get to the chronology later. I just want to first set the scene. What kind of a place is Wuhan?
It's a fishing hamlet. It's right on the east coast of Guangdong. There's a small harbor with fishing boats. Lots of people make their living that way. There's also farmland. It's a beautiful area. There's hills that back up the village, and there's an inlet that comes into it. And it's just a small.
Sounds like a nice place, then.
Right. It's small alleyways. People are very religious there. They burn incense. There's probably 7 or 8 temples in the town with temple squares.
What's the population?
13,000 or so.
13,000.
Yeah. Okay. Wow. So. It has that very classic life feel of these villages in Fujian or Guangdong, these southern villages.
So why don't a lot of you, I mean, I know Charlie, you were following this closely, and Gadi, of course. Let's build the chronology out really quickly, just sketching it of what happened. It goes back to September, is that correct?
Well, I think Charlie did a pretty good job of charting some of the early days and putting together a compelling video of what happened.
Over to you then, Charlie.
Yeah, so, I mean, they say it started in the 90s, right? And over the 90s, sort of starting in the early 1990s, the village officials were selling off this land that belonged to the villagers. It sort of all came to a head in September of this year when the news came out about this big deal that was selling this big parcel of villagers' land. And this is at the same time inflation was also very high, so villagers were sort of more and more feeling like we'd like to farm this land. So they went to confront the officials, and the official response was basically to bring out the police. There was some police violence, and you can see that in the video. But then after that,
the whole party leadership was driven out of the village.
I mean, short term, yes, but they did sort of come to a kind of uneven peace. This is back in September. And so my understanding anyway is that then from then until December, it sort of calmed down a little bit and it wasn't like this sort of village in open revolt. But then in December, according to the villagers, right, they said government essentially just suddenly kidnapped 5 of their representatives. One of them died while in police custody. The villagers say he was beaten. And so that then sparked them to revolt again, basically. And that was when they threw everybody out for good.
Okay. So that was in early December, right? That was December, I guess they reported his death on the 11th. When did Malcolm Moore get wind of this? I think we should all tip our hats to him, intrepid bit of journalism heading down to this village, right? When did he actually show up on scene?
Well, I think December 11th was when they repelled a police attack on their village. And there were some initial reports, I think, on the AFP and some other people reported on this development, and then Malcolm made it in on Tuesday after that.
I mean, that seems a little bit surprising to me.
He says he flew into Shenzhen, drove up there, had a rental car, and they slipped behind a government convoy that was driving past a police cordon.
And how, what about the rest of them? I mean, quite a few reporters ended up there.
Then people started going down, and it was once you got down to sort of the larger town that's right next to the village, then you would hire sort of these drivers to take you on dirt roads past the police checkpoints and to the barricades where the villagers have set up these tree trunk barricades. And then once you got there, and they would let you into the village.
So the local officials were still making an effort to keep foreign media out?
They could have cut off internet access. They could have done a lot more than they did to do a media blackout in that area, which...
Okay. Jeremy, what did you get a sense of domestic coverage on the story? Was it non-existent? Was there anyone talking about this?
It was quite big on the internet, of course. There was a lot on Weibo about it, even after Sina started censoring. Yeah. People were using WK as a sort of a cipher to get around the censorship mechanism. And it was followed by a few editorials and opinion pieces in some of the papers, including the People's Daily. So it wasn't... probably covered in the local media, but it wasn't a complete blackout by any means.
Right. Well, I think this leads right to Ian Johnson's point in his essay about adaptive authoritarianism.
Yeah, which I thought was one of the more interesting pieces to come out of it. I mean, I think there were a lot of pieces that have now been written in the aftermath of Wuhan, how we interpret it, but the first big think piece was from Ian Johnson in the New York Review of Books. God, do you want to tell us what Ian was arguing in that?
Well, I have to say it's been a couple of weeks since I read it because Kim Jong-il died in between.
This is true.
But in general, he was arguing that that this we shouldn't see this as some sort of inflection point, and that the Chinese government is has a lot of experience in dealing with unrest over the years, and a big part of it is allowing a lot of expression as a kind of a release valve. And there's been varying forms of this over many years, in terms of how this kind of is reflected in you know how much is allowed in whether it's blogosphere, where you see a little bit of allowing for grassroots expression of discontent and wait them out, negotiate, eventually maybe deal with the ringleaders. Mm-hmm. And so this was just a dramatic form of that. And his point was, you know, the government is constantly adapting to whatever the new realities are.
Were we all surprised at how lenient they were and how quickly they came to terms?
Didn't surprise me at all.
We don't know yet exactly how lenient they're going to be. I mean,
right. This is the right move to make first. Like this thing was linked was going to just keep going on and with the international press attention, et cetera. It's like okay, first immediately give concessions, quiet this whole thing down. And later on we'll,
later on lock up some people that should be locked up, bribe or pay off some other people.
Right.
And then you're sweet. But this is not new. I mean, even in Ian Johnson's article, he refers to an academic who coined that phrase,
adaptive authoritarianism.
This phrase is a new way of putting something we've discussed on this podcast before, I think, which is consultative Leninism.
Yeah, sure.
It's basically
right.
The same idea. It's you're not changing the essential structure of the way you rule China. All you're doing is being a little bit more responsive to the public's needs.
Ed, one of the pieces that you wrote, well, the main piece that you wrote, was about the use of the Western media, how they set up a press center, they gave you guys internet connections, they had a smiling Jesus above you on the wall.
Right. Although I don't think that part was planned. I think the house belonged to Christians.
Right.
But no, let's hear about this. Do you really feel like the Western media presence made a difference in the way this story ended?
Well, on the surface, I feel like a protest like this looks like a lot of other protests that took place. In fact, the level of violence in this was much less than other protests we've seen elsewhere, like where you see the people completely burned down a police station or something.
Right.
So the level of drama actually wasn't as high as other protests I've seen reported by the Chinese media. But the fact that Western reporters were able to get in and just do reportage from inside definitely put a spotlight on it. Usually, like people won't just jump on a plane and get in there immediately, but Malcolm Moore did that, and then his story along with Charlie's really got everyone's attention. And I think that...
Wow, Charlie, did you hear that?
And I do think that that helped put a spotlight on it. Otherwise, I think it would just have been diffused same way a lot of other protests have been diffused across China.
I mean, I think we should take just a quick word about Russell Lee Moses' post. He was trying to debunk the idea that this is a new normal in the way that the Chinese government's going to be handling. And then I want to move on to talk about Hyman. Anyone have something to say about Rob Peace?
I mean, I saw Russ's piece, and that got my attention was the line where he says, "Oh, this has widened the rift between elements in the party on how to handle protests," which I'm not like to see what evidence there is that there was this rift, and also that the Wuhan incident has become this signature event among senior officials on how to deal with it.
I did read piece too, Kaiser. I had an issue with the straw man kind of
right. Thing. I just simply didn't see anyone claiming that this is a new normal. I don't know who he's actually directing this at.
Right.
Did anyone see anyone who was saying, "Oh, this is a gigantic new breakthrough"? I think maybe are we all just sort of jaded, but
no. I think that's a point. I mean, I think, and we'll get to this with Han, but or at least I'll bring this up. But the Wenzhou train crash made people think there was a new normal. But I didn't see nearly as much. There was a little bit of, you know, town revolts sort of thing, and a little bit of sensationalism.
Sure.
To go with the story, but I don't think there was an overall judgment that this is a, you know, new normal.
Well, not too far away, in another fishing village called Haimen, there was a major protest against a power plant that was being built, or that was planned, or was on the books, or whatever, that would apparently use a lot of seawater for cooling, scare away the fish, and destroy the livelihoods.
The second plant to be built.
Right, the second plant to be built, right. There was already one. What was the difference in the way that this was handled? Anyone cover that story? If not, we'll just...
Yeah, I was in Kim Jong-il territory.
Oh, okay, all right.
This is part of the jaded quality. I think it seemed like a lot of other protests.
I mean, this is, I guess, what I was trying to say a little earlier, is that these things go on all the time. You know, the 2006 figure was 80,000 released by the government, and they haven't released...
no, there's a 2009 figure of 90,000.
Oh, 90,000. Right. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, so basically, even if you...
The rumors are there's more than 100,000 a year.
Yeah, 100,000 mass incidents. It's not new. It's been going on for years and years and years.
Well, you remember the 2001 labor protests, which were much larger, I mean, much bigger deal that people thought would portend something new, rounded up the ringleaders, and we didn't have a repeat of that episode.
Okay, let's move on and talk about Han right now. These three blog posts that went up on the 25th, titled On Revolution, On Democracy, and Wanting Freedom. Do these represent a departure, any kind of a palpable ideological shift for Han Han?
No, I mean, it's funny
this
because...
This is Charlie now. Charlie,
let's introduce him properly. Charlie at one point was translating pretty much everything Han Han wrote. So right. I think you're quite well-placed.
Yeah, you're
well-placed
to talk about this. And actually, we had you on the very first podcast that we did about Han Han nearly 2 years ago. But Yeah,
so I don't think so. And Evan Osnos sort of helped me out by writing a piece that says the same thing. But I mean, he's always been kind of like, you know, in all his pieces, he's edgy and he's really sarcastic, which sometimes the sort of the sarcasm and the humor makes you feel like he's being a little bit more edgy than he actually is.
Well, also, yeah, it's true.
But in these pieces, I don't think he didn't really say anything in terms of like his politics that contradicts anything that he said before. You know, he's not Ai Weiwei, right? He never has been writing articles about how China needs to revolt and overthrow the government or whatever. So I don't think it's not as big a departure as people have said.
So why this sense of betrayal by all the more stridently active intellectuals?
Because I think a lot of people were sort of projecting on him a little bit. I mean, he's got that sort of bad boy image, and he's got the really sort of biting flavor that a lot of Chinese dissidents sort of have going on in their heads at any given time.
So Gotti, Ian Johnson actually wrote me and with a question. He said that his Chinese friends in Berlin, they're saying that he's having one over on us, that he's just, this is satire, that he's sort of channeling the apologist voice for the government just to show everyone how ridiculous it sounds when actually articulated.
Okay, so. I don't think it's satire. And I actually don't agree with the premise that he's taking the authoritarian government's mindset.
Right.
I mean, he does, I think, subscribe to a few of their sort of most popular talking points.
But, like the Suger argument.
Right.
Well, let's get to that later.
But I think he's at root much more of an idealist and a lover of kind of liberty than anybody on the authoritarian government side of the question.
Oh, yeah.
It's just that he's in his mind, he's a realist, you know. He's very cynical, and I think the reason that people project those kind of attitudes on him is that he usually addresses his cynicism at authority figures, at kind of conventional thinkers. So whatever he's attacking, they think they're that he's with them, and that they're with him.
Remind us about the conversations that you had with him on the midway point between Shanghai and Beijing, that rally race.
Right. So I was in Zhaozhuang a couple of months ago to do a piece for the World in 2012 issue for The Economist. And this was the first, I had actually profiled him now 9 years ago or eight years ago in the Baltimore Sun. And I would say his evolution of thinking hasn't changed dramatically. He's always had this sort of limit to what he thinks is, wise or advisable in terms of rebellion. Right. I think he's never seen himself as a real rebel.
There's a lot of racing metaphors that he involved.
He was racing metaphors this time. He was already starting to race cars back then. At least he was training for it. And then this time he was like, at first he was talking about, yeah, you need to push, no push, like in motor racing, no push, no change.
Right.
But when you press him on it, he was like, well, I'm not going to do anything too radical next year because, going back to motor racing, I say no push, no change. But if you push too hard, then maybe you'll have problems. And if you push really too hard, you might crash. And it actually is very similar to the end of my interview with him in December 2002. We were on Chang'anjie, mm-hmm. And he was taking me out in his new, at 4 in the morning on a Saturday morning, in his new Mitsubishi race car. Actually, I think I did this for one of our first podcasts. He would race up to like 100 miles per hour on Chang'anjie, but he stopped all the red lights. To me, that captured Hunter.
There you go. That's interesting. It's the old Suzhou argument, again, repackaged.
It is the old Suzhou argument. And, maybe there's some merit to it.
I think it's more than just the old Suzhou argument, though. It's about respect for rights in general. We'd like to think about things from the other person's perspective. He's saying that people don't care about that. And I think that is, it's an interesting point. You shouldn't use it in service of arguing against, democratic transformation. But he's saying people don't really kind of put themselves in other people's shoes. There's limits to it.
I mean, I think that's very true. Anyone who tries to get out of an elevator when other people are trying to get in China, you don't even have to drive to experience the lack of
awareness. I'm sure the Good Samaritan stuff this year, the UAUA, had an impact on his thinking, too. And I actually wanted to bring up, I talked about the Wenzhou thing being an inflection point for change, or people thinking that it was going to be a big change with Weibo and everything. And I asked him about it at this point in Zhaozhuang.
Uh-huh.
And he was like, I don't like Weibo. And I don't think I think the direct quote is that it doesn't bring about any real change or progress. You see a lot of stuff about the Wenzhou incident. You feel everyone's really angry. You feel like you could go open the window and you would see protesters out on the street. But once you open the window, you realize there's nothing there at all.
That's very interesting.
And he went on about that. I didn't have room for it here to talk about how the microblog kind of means that you run through these stories really quickly and it desensitizes you, as he wrote in his essays.
He's been either reading Malcolm Gladwell or Evgeny Morozov.
It's an interesting thought, but I think it shows how deep his disappointment actually is. It's not a pro-government argument.
It's just a deep cynicism about...
It's not just cynicism. It's also there's a dismay that comes from idealism. And I think that's what the naivete at the core of the piece.
Okay.
I think that there is a naivete to his writing here. And actually, I find that to be somewhat redeeming.
So in a conversation I had with Bill Bishop earlier, he's not shy about his endorsement of Hanhan's take in this trio of blog posts. But he sees something more at work here. What he thinks Hanhan has done effectively is to create a massive out in the open dialogue about three very, very sensitive topics, revolution, democracy, freedom. And he's cleverly staked out a position that he knows full well isn't going to get him in any trouble. Meanwhile, it provides sort of cover for this conversation to take place.
That was actually the first Chinese comment that I saw on the articles at all, which, I don't know to what extent that was really Hanhan's goal, but he certainly has accomplished. I mean, even in the context of him sort of taking the party line a bit, he has created a bigger discussion about these sort of fundamental, like democracy and freedom and revolution, than we've seen in however long. Like, everybody's talking about it.
But there is, like, in his, especially on revolution essay, there is sort of like, we talked about straw man arguments earlier, and it does seem like he's setting up a straw man argument just so people can react, because I don't know about you, but I don't know very many Chinese, even liberal Chinese, who endorse the idea of a revolution or a sudden overthrow of a government here. There aren't very many. And even among, people who really dislike the party and its mechanisms. There's a lot more who are in a reform, what we might want to call a reform camp.
Yeah.
And so I feel like he's putting out an argument there that not a lot of people, like he's arguing against something that not a lot of people would counteract him on. So then what's the...
And yet they are, though. I mean, yet a lot of people come
out. No, but come on, let's look at... It's not like it started this firestorm of conversation and confrontation.
Do you think that we're overplaying that then?
I think we're overplaying that a little.
Okay.
I think one thing that was clever about this that maybe people haven't given him credit for is that he embedded some very strident criticism of the government, like, you know, throughout.
Oh, yeah.
And, I mean, he does get credit for that, but if you read it like just with an eye for that, it's pretty impressive, I think, pretty damning. So
it makes one quite sad about China, the whole thing, because this is sort of the best we can expect at the moment, is this kind of, you know, absolute lack of conviction about anything. I mean, even if I may quote from his one on in Roland Sung's translation. He says, in the new year, I earnestly ask the authorities to let culture, publishing, press, and cinema be freer. Go Han, I totally agree.
Sure.
And then he goes on to say, if this can be done, then I personally make these promises in the freer cultural environment. I will not try to settle old scores. I will look ahead. I will not discuss the sensitive issues in history. I will not discuss or criticize the senior level groups or their families or their relevant interests. I will only criticize and comment on current social issues. You know, so he's basically saying, look, if you don't totally break my balls and lock me up and fuck with me, then I promise not to actually write about anything that you actually care about. And this is the terrible situation that Chinese culture finds itself in now. Even somebody like this, who's really smart, really funny, gets so many things about the contemporary situation. And what he's essentially saying is, I will cut off my balls if you just let me keep my head.
Right. I agree, it's the absolute worst part of all three essays.
It's so sad.
It's the saddest part.
It's the tragedy of contemporary Chinese culture.
I have that bolded up in my text here as well. It's terrible. But if you have to take these kind of things in their totality. I think, you know, he's written a lot of things to think about here.
The totality is this: we know that there's going to be no progress on this type of thing. The progress is going to be infinitesimal.
Well, I think he's laying the groundwork here. He is, I think, kind of put a marker in the ground. It's like, all right, this is how much of a toady I'm willing to be right now. That's going to change. I mean, that's my hopeful kind of interpretation.
It's still pretty fucking depressing, though.
Yeah.
Freedom isn't free, you know. I mean, if even the people who are supposed to have balls can't fight.
But let's. I mean, what we need to realize here is that the from where I sit, it really looks like, you know, this is sort of showing light on the chasm between all those middle-brow folks who are admirers of Han and the more sort of rarefied, strident activists, the Ai Weiwei's of the world, and it. My worry is that it renders them more impotent. I mean, they can't even play the role of sort of the moral goalpost anymore. I mean, because now that they can be dismissed as, you know, so irrelevant.
It renders the activists as morally. I don't think so.
People, he's sort of played into it, especially, you know, like Michael Antti says, oh, my reaction is I think he should read more.
I mean, Antti's remark is absolutely right. Han needs to read more.
Well, we all need to read more.
Also, I don't think, I mean, when you look at Han's image, I don't think he's ever had this image as this unadulterated sort of, like, flag bearer. He's a more complicated figure than sort of the, the intellectual liberal reformist. Like, he's never truly played that role. And so I don't think that I don't see it as him leaving him that camp or betraying that camp, because he was never of it purely to begin with.
I think to remark on Jeremy's point and Charlie's, I mean, I have to say I totally agree. It's the most damning section, this one particular point. It reveals what's at the heart of what he's writing.
But it's not damning just of him. I mean, I don't think it's damning of him. I think he's done a good thing with these three essays. I think he has actually caused discussion about these three concepts, and I think that's good. And I think he's a person who should be encouraged to do whatever he wants to do. What I think it is damning of is the absolute fossilization of cultural progress in this country at the moment, where even somebody like that the best they can do is to say, oh, please, just give me a little itty, bitty, 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 little okay, itty, bitty freedom. I mean, that's where we're at.
Well, but this is where we see, I mean, he's being A, maybe, this is back to this naivete point, where he thinks he's a realist. He thinks that this is the way that you have to talk to the government. But I think at heart he knows that this is going nowhere. And, you know, I think he's not going to stick to this particular ground, you know.
Yeah.
But I think maybe what is right about it is, I mean, is a point that there is a lot of interest in the status quo on the part of not just people who are government officials, but a broad cross-section of society. I think that is absolutely correct.
As long as they, as he puts it, don't end up a victim of injustice themselves.
Right.
So, which he says most people aren't. I don't know. I might disagree with his assessment about most people.
Depends how you define injustice. Yeah.
You know, I mean, Sorry. Everybody's not a victim of injustice until they are.
Right. I know. I generally agree with the point that he's saying that basically people do not, basically have any sort of real dissatisfaction with the government until they're personally affected.
Until their kid's kidney explodes after drinking milk.
But that number keeps growing.
Right.
Folks, let's wrap this up. And thanks a lot, Gotti. Welcome back again.
Thanks.
Good to have you back. And Ed, as always, great to have you. And Charlie, so Jeremy, are we taking a break next week?
We'll see.
Okay, ad hoc kind of. And hopefully, so we'll see you when you see ya.